The UN Human Rights Office says the crackdown on anti-coup protesters in Myanmar has left at least 18 people dead and over 30 wounded. The latest numbers of dead coming from reporting by the Associated Press. The Human Rights Office is attributing the numbers to credible information. A statement from the office says the deaths happened as a result of live ammunition fired into crowds in Yangon, Dawei, Mandalay, Mayak, Bago, and Pococu. The statement went on, quote, tear gas was also reportedly used in various locations, as well as flashbang and stun grenades. 18 dead would be the highest single-day death toll among protesters who are demanding that the elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi be restored to power after being ousted by a February 1st coup. Hong Kong police have detained 47 pro-democracy activists on charges of conspiracy to commit subversion under the sweeping national security law. The former lawmakers and democracy advocates had been previously arrested in January, but were released. They've been detained again and will appear in court on Monday. They allegedly violated the new national security law that was imposed by Beijing for participating in unofficial election primaries for the semi-autonomous Chinese territory's legislature last year. Former U.S. President Donald Trump is scheduled to speak at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference in the city of Orlando, Florida, on Sunday. Since the conclusion of his presidency, some Republicans have argued that the party must move on from the former president to win back voters who abandoned them in November's presidential election. This is VOA News. The Taliban demanded Sunday that the United States and its foreign military allies leave Afghanistan by May 1st. The departure would be in line with a peace agreement the insurgent group signed with Washington a year ago. In a statement marking the first anniversary of the February 2020 accord sealed in Doha, Qatar, the Taliban claimed they have fully adhered to the understanding aimed at ending two decades of Afghan war. It called on Washington to honor its part of what the group described as an historic deal. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration is currently reviewing the deal his predecessor sealed with the Afghan insurgency. NATO-led U.S. allies have fewer than 10,000 troops left in the country. A UN humanitarian agency has warned that more than 16 million people in Yemen would go hungry this year. The nation already has some 500,000 living in famine-like conditions in the conflict-wrecked country. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says the risk of large-scale famine in the Arab world's poorest country has never been more acute. The stark warning comes a day before a pledging conference co-hosted by Sweden and Switzerland. Yemen's war started in 2014 when the Houthis seized the capital Sana'a and much of the country's north. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has cleared Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine for emergency use in the country. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
The FDA decision adds a third vaccine option in the fight to control the coronavirus, but unlike the first two, which require two shots, Johnson & Johnson's works with just one dose. The FDA said J&J's vaccine offers strong protection against what matters most, serious illness, hospitalizations, and death. In a massive study that spanned three continents, one dose was found to be 85% protective against the most severe COVID-19 illness. J&J has a few million doses lined up, and shipments could begin as early as Monday. The company expects to deliver 20 million doses around the U.S. by the end of March and 100 million by summer. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is expected to ask President Biden to consider sharing part of the U.S. coronavirus vaccine supply with its poorer southern neighbor. The conversation could happen when the two leaders hold a virtual summit on Monday, according to U.S. and Mexican officials. Read more stories on voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal, and our moderator is Dan Raviv, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. With Joe Biden now in his second month as President of the United States, his foreign policy appears to be quite different from the policies and attitudes of Donald Trump. We'll explore what we're seeing so far. The Biden cabinet is taking shape, although at least one of the president's nominees was having trouble in the process that requires them to be confirmed by a majority of the U.S. Senate. And the coronavirus has now caused more than 500,000 deaths here in the United States, more than in any other country. Yet some parts of America have plans to reopen schools, some businesses, and entertainment such as sports events. The availability of new vaccines is clearly helping. But first, foreign policy. President Biden has a slogan. He says, America is back. He had his first summit with a foreign leader. That was Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada. It was a virtual summit. They were connected by video link. Mr. Biden said the United States has no closer friend than Canada. And Prime Minister Trudeau was obviously criticizing the previous Trump policies when he said U.S. leadership has been sorely missed over the past years. And Trudeau also said it was nice to have an American government that's not removing every mention of climate change. Linda Feldman, can we take Trudeau as an example of foreign leaders, well, whose contempt for Trump, maybe that's too strong a word, is no longer a secret?
I don't know that contempt is too strong a word. I think you may recall that moment a couple of years ago when you had Justin Trudeau and a couple of other world leaders standing around. It was like the high school cafeteria talking about Donald Trump, it would appear. And yeah, they did not like the man. Much relief that he's off the world stage. But U.S.-Canada relations, it's not a complete easy street at this point. On his first day in office, Joe Biden decommissioned the Keystone XL pipeline, which was very important for Canadian energy purposes. So it's a new day in U.S.-Canada relations, but these things are never without complications.
As you say, foreign policy isn't just a matter of flipping a switch and changing, except for the slogan. America is back is so different from what Donald Trump had said, America first. Tom, what's your take? And just in general, you know, Donald Trump's still there, whether it's the policies of his 4 years or the fact that he wants to still be a major political figure. So Trump is not disappearing from the political scene, Tom.
Not yet, Dan, and he doesn't want to disappear from the political scene. He's gone from Washington. He's no longer president. His power has waned, but his power within the Republican Party has not waned. He is still the most dominant individual in that party, and he's making all kind of noises about running in 2024, which I personally believe will end up not happening, but he's trying to maintain his political appeal with tens of millions of Americans. Some of them are probably very happy he's gone, but many of them also believe, firmly believe, that the election was stolen from him, which is clearly not the case. So he's trying to stay relevant as best he can.
Linda, what do you make of Donald Trump's continued influence? I noticed that one of the few Republican critics of Trump in the U.S. Senate, Mitt Romney, says that if Trump competes for the party nomination to run for president in 2024, Trump would almost certainly win that nomination.
So that's how things might look now, but there is a lot of time to go. I mean, political predictions about 2024 made now must be taken with a grain of salt. And I agree with Tom. I think ultimately Trump will not run. I think he's sort of fanning this speculation that he will run because he loves the attention. He loves having influence over the party. He's lost his access to Twitter. So the times when he does appear in public and make public statements, like on Fox News, this just feeds Donald Trump like nothing else. But running again is a completely different matter. I mean, he'll be, by 2024, he'll be 4 years older. And he now knows, A, how hard it is to be president, or maybe he doesn't because he seemed to take a lot of executive time. It's just a lot of work. Running is a lot of work. And it may be that in a couple of years, when the race gets serious, that there will be other Republicans on the stage who have captured some attention.
There are quite a few political pundits who expect that Donald Trump and his real estate company, maybe some members of his family, could face legal difficulties with even criminal investigations, say by the state of New York, and that could damage Trump, though some say in a way it could help him because his supporters would be so resentful. Tom, what should we think about the possibility that Donald Trump will have legal troubles?
Well, I don't think there's any question that he will have legal troubles, and he already has them. The Supreme Court has now, in recent days, said he, Trump, cannot shield his tax returns and his financial data from New York prosecutors. And that, I think, is the last word on that one. This information that Trump has fought from releasing for years and years will now have to be released and presented to a state grand jury in New York. Whatever happens from there remains to be seen. But he's got all sorts of legal challenges, some civil, some criminal, and he's going to have to spend a lot of time dealing with all of that. I think he is in some jeopardy. It's way too early to know just how vulnerable he is. I mean, some people say he's going to end up being in jail before it's all over. I doubt that, but there's no question he has a problem with the law in some fashion, and it's going to tie him up and complicate his life going forward.
Let's keep in mind that during his 4 years as president, Donald Trump was impeached twice by the House of Representatives. That's never happened to any other president. In both cases, there was a trial in the Senate, and there was not a two-thirds majority to convict President Trump. Let's talk about some more foreign policy changes. Whereas Trump had withdrawn from the United Nations Human Rights Council, the Biden administration says it wants to be back on that council, even though it is flawed, as the Biden administration puts it. Meantime, the Biden team decided to release to the public results of a U.S. investigation into the violent death of Jamal Khashoggi. You'll recall, a citizen of Saudi Arabia living in the United States, writing for an American newspaper. Khashoggi was a dissident lured to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, where he was murdered in 2018. It was understood that the CIA and other American agencies found that the killing was probably ordered by the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Saudi Arabia denies that. Donald Trump avoided blaming the Crown Prince. Now, Linda, I noticed one form of diplomatic punishment was that President Biden had a plan to phone the king of Saudi Arabia and apparently to protest the killing of Khashoggi. And the president pointedly would not speak with the crown prince, known as MBS. And in the background, Biden also is cutting off military aid to the war in Yemen, waged by Saudi Arabia and its Arab allies, who say they're fighting pro-Iran rebels in Yemen. Linda, is there a major break with Saudi Arabia?
I don't see a major break. Saudi Arabia, of course, is a key regional power. It's a check on Iran. So we can't lose the Saudis altogether. But the president's press secretary, Jen Psaki, made a point in a briefing of noting that the king of Saudi Arabia is the appropriate person for President Biden to speak with and not his son, the crown prince. This is a sharp break from how the Trump administration used to operate, where the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, used to have conversations with MBS. So this is yet another example of how the Biden White House is trying to kind of put things back on a normal diplomatic course.
A lot of people are wondering whether the Biden administration is trying to send out friendly feelers toward Iran, you know, by cooling things somewhat with Saudi Arabia. Of course, on the record, Secretary of State Tony Blinken has said that the U.S. wants to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal of 2015, the deal that Trump walked away from in 2018. Blinken says the U.S. wants to negotiate a better deal with stronger restrictions on Iran's nuclear work, and this time hoping also to limit development of new missiles. But Republicans in Congress and elsewhere in the U.S. say Biden and Blinken are soft on Iran, maybe even naive, and political conservatives warn that Iran will build nuclear weapons, that any new deal would expire in a few years. And Tom, when it comes to foreign policy, this Iran nuclear issue it is a pretty strong political issue in Washington.
I think there's no doubt about that, Dan. The Biden administration wants to engage or re-engage. Their attitude is talking is better than a military action. But Biden has said that he is not going to lift sanctions against Iran, period, until they agree to stop trying to produce nuclear weapons, nuclear bombs. That's a pretty hard red line there. So, again, I think basically the Biden people are saying, let's talk, but we're not going to give away the store, which the Republicans disagree with and think that Biden will give away the store. We will just see. I think this is one issue upon which Biden and the Democrats and the Republicans are just at total cross purposes. I mean, there's no middle ground politically, at least at the moment.
Linda, what are you hearing about the Iran issue? Secretary Blinken says publicly the U.S. is working with its European allies, Britain, Germany, and France on this, all of them part of the nuclear deal with Iran. But questions kept coming up at various briefings in Washington as to whether there are secret talks between the U.S. and Iran, which is what happened back in 2015, yes?
Exactly. So the issue of how the United States deals with countries with which it does not have formal relations always involves secret communications. I mean, you can not have a formal relationship, especially when it's a major country like Iran. We still have to deal with them. So the UN is an obvious venue for that. And one of the early, I think, goodwill gestures by the Biden administration after they took office was to lift the very restrictive rules that the Trump administration had put on the Iranian diplomatic mission in New York, giving them a lot more room to roam, let's say, in the New York area. But as you said, so far, there's no real breakthrough in the efforts to revive the Iran nuclear deal. The Iranians just, they want the sanctions lifted. The U.S. will not give up on that. And we're demanding that they come into full compliance with the accord. So as Tom says, we're really at an impasse.
We'll talk about Joe Biden's cabinet and how the Senate, made up of 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans, holds the key to confirming cabinet members or rejecting them after this brief break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and our moderator, Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Tom, as of the time that we're recording this program for VOA News, there's one nominee to the Biden cabinet who may fail to win confirmation by the United States Senate. Neera Tanden, for many years head of a liberal think tank in Washington, was nominated to be head of OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, a powerful job in the cabinet overseeing spending and government operations. Now, President Biden said he's firmly confident in Tanden, but Republicans and a few Democrats in the Senate said they don't like her style. On Twitter especially, she had harsh criticism, even personal insults aimed at Republicans, but also at progressive Democrats and Senator Bernie Sanders. So Tanden made some enemies. The Senate might not approve her for this job. And Tom, I guess it's fairly common with the start of a new administration that at least one nominee fails to win a confirmation vote. Tom?
That's right. I mean, it used to be, and it still is for the most part, that a new president is basically entitled to the people around him. He's entitled to name people he's comfortable with as his senior officials and senior and cabinet officers. In recent years, you're right, somebody usually bites the dust early on, and at the moment it might be Neera Tanden. I have to say, though, the hypocrisy of the Republicans is literally eye-rolling in this sense. Donald Trump did tens of thousands of what are being called by the Republicans these days about Tanda, mean tweets. Well, her tweets are just too mean. She treats Republicans poorly in her tweets. That wasn't a problem with Republicans when Donald Trump was tweeting tens of thousands of messages calling people stone cold losers, wackos, low IQ, low energy. That didn't seem to bother the Republicans, but Tandon's tweets bothered them a lot. The bottom line is this is probably not the wisest of Biden's appointments. You would think someone would say, well, we may have a problem with a nominee who's for a president who's preaching unity and bipartisanship, and she's spent a lot of time on her Twitter account trashing Republicans in very stark terms. At the moment, she's in trouble. And you know she's in trouble because a couple of days ago, the two committees of the Senate that have to approve her nomination postponed hearings. And usually when a hearing is postponed in this kind of a circumstance, it means the nominee, in this case Tandon, doesn't have the votes to win. The White House is desperate to find one Republican who will break with his or her party and vote for Tandon to save her. At the moment, she is imperiled, to put it mildly.
President Biden was pleased, on the other hand, by the outcome for a distinguished former U.S. diplomat, Linda Thomas Greenfield. She was confirmed by the Senate to be U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. The vote was 78-20, important right now because for the whole month of March, the U.S. holds the presidency of the UN Security Council. And Linda Feldman, come in on this same subject. Biden gets almost all of his nominees confirmed by the Senate. It's quite right for Senate committees to have hearings and opponents to ask questions, but it's all part of the US system. There are nominees to be ambassador, to be cabinet officers, other government positions who don't just sail through.
Right. And in fact, this is by design. In the U.S. Constitution, under Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2, it calls for advice and consent, which is a reference to the Senate's role in approving or rejecting the appointments of top people, including cabinet members. Now, the exception to this is people who work with the president in the White House, which is a bow to the idea that the president should have whoever he wants literally at his side. But in terms of running cabinet agencies, that the Senate does have a say. And right now, the Senate is literally tied. It's 50-50 Democrat-Republican, with the Vice President Kamala Harris able to jump in and break a 50-50 tie. But this means that really President Biden really can't lose anybody on the Democratic side. And if he does, as he has done in the case of Neera Tanden, he has to lure in a Republican. I'm not sure it's going to work. In this case with Ms. Tanden, there's some thinking that she was almost put in there as a sacrificial lamb, as somebody who the Republicans can then shoot down. I'm not sure, you know, he thought that Joe Manchin in particular would reject her, given that it's possible, if not probable, that somebody more liberal than Neera Tanden would replace her if her nomination does fail.
Joe Manchin being a Democrat in the U.S. Senate, but representing a conservative state, West Virginia. Let's talk about the subject we hate to talk about. That's the worldwide pandemic, COVID-19. This past Wednesday, we heard something from international health officials that we rarely hear when it comes to COVID-19, that it was a day to celebrate. Because COVAX, led by the World Health Organization, aimed at reducing the gap between wealthy countries and poor ones, delivered vaccine doses to a developing country for the first time. The vaccines arrived in Ghana in West Africa. And Linda, the United States government is part of COVAX because while President Trump refused to join with his America First policy, President Biden has put the U.S. in COVAX. That implies a pledge to share some excess vaccine doses with countries that need them. Linda, especially on the health front, can you explain this change of attitude?
Well, the United States under Joe Biden very much wants to be a good citizen of the world. Donald Trump is all about America First, immunizing our people before anybody else, while Joe Biden definitely believes in getting as many Americans inoculated as quickly as possible. He also understands that we're the richest country in the world and that we can share and we can be generous with countries that are not as wealthy as we are. And so he immediately rejoined the United States into the World Health Organization, and COVAX is a part of that. The aim of COVAX is to reduce the gap between wealthy countries and the less wealthy. So this is good news for everybody because this virus doesn't know any international boundaries for sure. So the faster we can get the entire world immunized, the better.
The number of deaths keeps rising. In fact, the total in the United States has now exceeded 500,000 people who've died because of COVID-19. President Biden and Vice President Harris led an official moment of silence to remember the victims. But there's hope in the form of the vaccines. For about 3 months in the U.S., two vaccines are being used, one made by Moderna, a fairly new American company. The other is made by the U.S. company Pfizer with a German company, BioNTech. And now a large American corporation, Johnson & Johnson, has received permission for its vaccine against COVID-19. Expecting emergency use to start just about right away. Tom, the Johnson & Johnson version is only one injection. You don't have to come back for a second shot. Tom, do you agree that will help a lot when it comes to people all around the world agreeing to get the shot?
Yes, I think it will help an awful lot, Dan. And it's not just the fact that it's one injection as opposed to two injections spaced from 3 to 4 weeks apart. The other thing that's important about Johnson & Johnson is you can store the vaccine in a refrigerator, a normal refrigerator, whereas the previous two vaccines have to be stored at super ultra below freezing temperatures, which made the logistics and the distribution of those vaccines trickier and slower. So the Johnson & Johnson version is a big step forward, and not just because of the numbers. There'll be hundreds of millions of more vaccine doses available. And, you know, everyone's the same. If you have the choice between two shots and one shot, everybody would just as soon have one shot. So I think kind of psychologically, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine will make it easier for some people who have been what's called vaccine deniers to get off the fence and say, well, maybe I should just take this vaccine, because it is important that everybody who can take this vaccine.
Investigations continue into the shocking events of January 6th, 2 weeks before President Trump left office, when thousands of his followers who felt he was cheated in the election invaded the Capitol building. At least 5 deaths are blamed on the clashes that day. Linda, when senators this past Wednesday had a hearing where they questioned some of the police officers who'd been taken by surprise, you might think about 9/11, the terrorist attack 20 years ago. That seemed to expose an intelligence failure. Linda?
It was absolutely shocking. I mean, we kind of suspected this was the case when you consider how woefully unprepared the security was at the Capitol when the extremists decided to invade. But we saw this at the hearing with now former chiefs of security for the Capitol, basically couldn't agree on much of anything about what was happening when, who talked to whom when, requests for National Guard to be brought in. FBI intelligence reports had been submitted to the security forces, but that information either wasn't paid attention to or didn't make it up to the top commanders. So we're now in the process of setting up likely a commission, a nonpartisan independent commission, to study what happened, really along the lines of the 9/11 commission. I mean, this was in many ways another form of 9/11. Obviously, not nearly as many people died, but in some ways it was almost as shocking.
You know, during that hearing on the events of January 6th, one Republican senator, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, claimed that the invasion of the halls of Congress was not done by Trump supporters, but by leftists and anti-Trump people. Tom DeFrank, that's just one senator who's a Trump loyalist. But on the other hand, it does show how pro-Trump mythology persists.
Exactly right. I mean, Ron Johnson, who is up for re-election to the Senate in 2022, understands that he cannot break with Donald Trump. He recently, a couple of weeks ago, was quoted in an interview of saying voting against Trump on impeachment or other things would be suicidal for him and for other members of the Senate and the House Republicans as well. Trump still has a hold. He has a very strong hold on the apparatus of the Republican Party. Republican politicians are scared to death that if they cross Trump, he will find somebody to run against them in their primary races in 2022, and they're just scared to death about it. So I agree with Linda. I'll say again that I think at some point it'll be obvious that Trump's political power has begun to dissipate, but that is not now. He's still flying high within the Republican Party.
That's all the time we have for this broadcast as we look at American politics and so much more. Thanks to our panelists, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Dan Ravine.
VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Ever since our ancient ancestors gazed into the night skies to look at the stars, planets, and other celestial objects, humans have long wondered if we're alone in the cosmos. Considering the trillions of galaxies, stars, planets, moons, and other objects that exist in the known universe, many say that surely there must be others out there that are just like us or who are perhaps living in much more advanced civilizations. Hello, I am Rick Pantaleo, your host for this science edition of Press Conference USA. Today we're going to talk about the ongoing search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which is also called ETI. My special guest for today's program is Seth Shostak, senior astronomer at the SETI Institute in Pasadena, California. The SETI Institute, which began as a brief NASA project, is one of the world's leading organizations in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Dr. Seth Shostak joins me today by Skype. Seth, people have wondered for millennia if we're alone in the universe. When did this mere wonderment actually turn into a real search for extraterrestrial intelligence?
Well, you know, depending on you, how you view history, I think you could say that even in the 18th century, there were people who thought, or even make it the 17th century. Why hold back? When the first telescopes were turned on the heavens by Galileo and some of his buddies, like Kepler, they saw, for example, craters on the moon. Nobody had really seen those before the telescope. And, you know, they didn't know what they were. And many of them thought that these were cities, underground cities, and the craters were some sort of dome. So I guess you could call that a search for extraterrestrial intelligence. For a long time, people thought the moon might be populated. But the really big step forward happened at the end of the 19th century when this guy, Percival Lowell in Arizona, used his telescopes to look at Mars and thought he saw canals. Mm-hmm. Canals. Well, if there were canals on Mars, there were intelligent beings on Mars. So that was the beginning of what is now a much more sophisticated search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
You mentioned the end of the 19th century, and I can't help but think of the experiments Nikola Tesla was conducting, hoping to communicate. He said he communicated with Mars.
He did. He had this big tower in, I guess it was Colorado Springs. It was in Colorado. And, you know, he had a scheme that he thought could bring power into people's homes without using wires, just sort of broadcast the power. But it didn't work. That was a problem. But it was a big thing. It had a lot of wire. So it, you know, it was, as it turns out, a big antenna in a way. And he did hear something that he thought was broadcast from Mars. Now, most likely, it was what are called whistlers, and those are just an atmospheric phenomenon, lightning sort of reverberating in our atmosphere. But he thought he had heard the Martians. And by the way, he wasn't the only one to think that they had heard Mars. I mean, it was a rather common claim.
Can you help us understand the difference between science's search for signs of extraterrestrial life and extraterrestrial intelligent life? Are the two investigations linked?
Well, they're linked, but they're not the same. What we witnessed, the landing of the Perseverance rover, eventually what that rover is going to do is grab some samples, find some samples of the Martian surface there, you know, rock there on the surface that might have the remains of dead Martians. Those samples will eventually be brought back to Earth to be analyzed here. Those samples would be of dead Martians, but dead microbial Martians, bacteria, if you will. So that's the search for life. And by the way, Mars is not the only place nearby that might have dead microbes or even live microbes. Three of the moons of Jupiter, two of the moons of Saturn, these are all places where there might be life. But none of that life is going to hold your attention, hold up its side of the conversation, because it won't be intelligent. If you want to find intelligent life, you have to look much farther afield using big antennas like Jodie Foster did in the movie Contact, and we do some of that. So the methods are different, but the idea is even if they're intelligent beings out there, they presumably got started as microbes.
So we're talking about intelligence and extraterrestrial life. How is that defined? What is it that SETI is looking for?
Well, our definition of intelligence is very simple. If you can build a radio transmitter, then you're intelligent. So I ask my neighbors routinely, hey, can you build a radio transmitter? And most of them say no, but I still treat them as if they are intelligent. But it just means that they have enough smarts to be able to understand physics, to do engineering, to build big transmitters that could generate signals that we can pick up so that we know they're there. That's it.
When we're talking about search for extraterrestrial intelligence, you can't help but mention Dr. Frank Drake and the Drake equation. Can you tell us a little bit about the man and the equation?
Yes, absolutely. Frank Drake, who, by the way, in my opinion, is one of the world's last nice guys. He's just a wonderful guy. But in 1960, he had just graduated with his PhD from Harvard, I believe, and he took a job at a radio observatory in West Virginia, and they had just gotten a new antenna. So he was trying to think of something to use it for. I mean, there are a lot of astronomy questions you could use it for, but he thought it would be kind of interesting to actually try and use it to eavesdrop on alien signals. So he promised not to spend a lot of money on this project. And the director of the observatory said, yeah, give it a shot. So he spent about a couple of weeks, actually, pointing this antenna in the direction of some nearby stars, hoping that one or the other of them would have a planet with some aliens who are broadcasting our way. And that was the first modern SETI search. Now, he didn't find anything. I mean, he picked up signals, but they were due to the Air Force and not the Martians or anybody else. But that's the way we've been doing it ever since, trying to eavesdrop on the aliens.
Can you tell us a bit about the Drake equation itself? Because I understand it's basically defining the number of intelligent alien civilizations that exist in the universe.
Yes, indeed. And it came about this way. Frank did this experiment, as we just described. That was in 1960. And it generated a lot of interest. There were big articles in Collier's Magazine, which was one of the more popular magazines at the time. And so he was encouraged to have a meeting to discuss this whole idea that you might be able to find the aliens with a big antenna. And so the next year, 1961, he scheduled a meeting. There were about 12 or 13 people in attendance. These are all very smart people, physicists, astronomers, whatever. And Frank was thinking, well, I'm going to have this meeting next week. I need an agenda. So he came up with this equation, which is now known as the Drake equation, in which he tried to estimate, well, how many societies are out there right now that are broadcasting signals we might pick up right now, okay? And it just depends on, well, how many stars are out there and what fraction of the stars have planets and what fraction of those planets are the kind where ET might want to live and that sort of stuff. So that became known as the Drake equation. And by the way, it's often said to be the second most famous equation in all of science after E equals MC squared from Einstein.
I understand that the early searches concentrated on a region of the radio section of the electromagnetic spectrum known as the water hole. What is the water hole and why is it important in searching for ETI?
Well, this was a suggestion that was made right at the beginning. Even in 1960, Frank was listening. He was tuning, if you will, his receiver to a frequency that is in the water hole. It turns out that nature actually makes a lot of natural radio static. It wouldn't be terribly interesting to listen to, but things like quasars and pulsars and Jupiter and the sun, they all make radio noise. It would sound like you're just turning on your kitchen faucet and listening to that for a while. I think you'd get tired of it after a bit. But anyhow, so it makes all these noises. But there are some frequencies where nature makes more noise. And one of them is at the frequency produced by natural hydrogen, ordinary hydrogen, which fills most of the universe, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's hydrogen everywhere. And OH, which is the hydroxyl radical. So oxygen and hydrogen. And that's at a somewhat higher frequency. These two frequencies, they're like the old Conelrad frequencies, if anybody remembers those, that used to be on the dials of everybody's home radio, right? These frequencies are where you listen in case of nuclear attack. And these are frequencies that all the aliens will know about because they're defined by nature. So the thought was, if the aliens are trying to get in touch, These two frequencies will tell us where on the dial we should tune.
Can you give us a little bit of insight into how the SETI searches are conducted? I know you scan the radio frequencies. How is this done?
Actually, it's done very similarly to what Frank Drake did in 1960, except that the equipment, of course, is far, far better. But, you know, the basic idea is the same. You point your antennas, and the bigger the antenna, the better. Bigger really is better, because if it's bigger, it can pick up fainter signals. And, you know, the aliens are going to be far away, so being able to pick up something faint is a good deal. So you point them in the direction of these nearby star systems, and you just listen to as much of the radio dial as you can, looking for signals that are what are called narrow band. Now, that's a technical term, but it just means that the signal is at one spot on the radio dial, not all over the dial, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody tunes in their favorite radio station. Well, it's at 740 kilohertz or 1500 kilohertz, whatever it is. It's at some spot on the dial. So if you find a signal like that, you say, well, I don't know what it is, but it's made by a transmitter. And so that's what we essentially do.
And I'm sure over the course of the years, as technology increased, you started using technology like computers to help you analyze the signals?
Yeah, well, absolutely. The whole thing is done with computers. In fact, the search, and people will occasionally ask me at parties, they will occasionally ask, well, how would you be able to tell that it's an alien signal? Are you listening for them to send us their top 40? Are they sending us the value of pi or, you know, some mathematical series? Again, we're just looking for narrowband signals. But the whole thing is done with computers. And the faster the computer you have, the more of the radio dial you can scrutinize for signals. So the experiment keeps getting faster and faster. When people ask me at those parties, don't you get bored doing the same thing year after year after year? No, because the experiment keeps getting better. And that's because of computers.
And I want to look at a couple of milestones in SETI, and I'm thinking about the iconic Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico. It was a radio telescope that was destroyed when it recently collapsed, and I understand the radio telescope played a role in SETI research. How so, and tell me, what is this Arecibo message I've been hearing about?
Yes, well, then the message is, I've collapsed. Well, in fact, the Arecibo telescope was the biggest telescope, radio telescope, in the world for a very long time. It was built in the early 1960s, and it was 1,000 feet across.
It was a huge disc, yes.
Oh, it's huge. And, if you've ever been down there and taken a look at it, I reckon it could hold 2 billion scoops of ice cream. That antenna was the biggest in the world up until a couple of years ago. The Chinese had built something even bigger. But because it was so big, it was very sensitive. It was sort of like a bucket for radio waves, and a bigger bucket collects more radio waves. So that was the idea. Unfortunately, something has gone wrong. Those cables corroded, and the whole thing began to collapse last summer. And now it's completely collapsed. And the question is, will they be able to build it again, or are they going to give up on it?
What about the Arecibo message? What was that exactly?
The Arecibo message. Yeah, that was sent in 1977 or 74. Anyhow, in the 1970s, they had just made an improvement to the Arecibo telescope, and they wanted to have a little ceremony, a little party, if you will. And Frank Drake was, in fact, the director of the observatory at that time. And he said, well, as part of the celebration, I mean, in addition to the hors d'oeuvres and the drinks, we should send a message out into space, because Arecibo also had a transmitter. Most radio telescopes don't, but the Arecibo telescope did, a very powerful transmitter. So they, for 10 minutes, they aimed the antenna in the direction of a big cluster of stars, and they sent this, essentially, it's a picture. You know, if you saw it, it would look like a crossword puzzles with white and black squares, except the white and black squares made pictures, sort of what we look like and what DNA is made of and things like that. So that is the Arecibo message. Now, mind you, we haven't gotten any reply, but on the other hand, these stars are very far away, so you shouldn't expect a reply for about another 25,000 years.
A related phenomenon was something called the WOW signal.
Yeah, the WOW signal, maybe one of the most famous signals ever picked up by a SETI experiment, but that's, I think, largely because it has such a nifty name. There was a big antenna actually near Columbus, Ohio, run by Ohio State University as a radio telescope, but then it became sort of out of date for radio astronomy. So they just had it scan the sky, you know, continuously 24/7, trying to find signals from ET. And, you know, every day or two, one of the astronomers would come into the little shack where they had the equipment, and he would rip the print out off the line printer. Back in those days, computers put their output in the form of paper, printed paper. And one day he came in and there was a signal on it, and it was so impressive. It looked just like what they were hoping to find, that he wrote "Wow" next to it. Mm-hmm. So that became the "Wow" signal. Was it ET? Probably not, but we don't know what it was because it was never, ever seen again.
Let's take a break now. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Here's a reminder that Press Conference USA is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/PCUSA, and from many streaming services such as Apple Podcasts. We also hope you'll check out our Facebook and Twitter pages at Carol Castiel VOA for alerts and program updates. So now let's get back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Today, we're talking about the ongoing search for extraterrestrial intelligence with Seth Shostak, the senior astronomer at the SETI Institute in Pasadena, California. Seth, before the break, we were talking about the Arecibo message that was transmitted into space with hopes it could reach members of an extraterrestrial intelligent civilization. The late Stephen Hawking expressed concern that perhaps we shouldn't draw attention to ourselves because such an advanced alien civilization may not be the friendly ET type, but malevolent and not have any problem wiping out the human race the way a human might wipe out a colony of ants. With this in mind, should we be sending out messages that identify us and where we live?
Well, you know, it's really hard to kind of guess what the aliens would find interesting to do, Rick. I mean, who knows? But so what, you know, Hawking was saying is, since you don't know what their interests are you willing to take the chance by transmitting and letting anybody who's listening know that we're here? And maybe, you know, the aliens will say, hey, wait, the radio signal's coming from that world over there next to the yellow star. And they might compete with us in the used car market or who knows what. And so we better wipe them out now. I mean, that's a possibility. Doesn't strike me as very likely, but there's not much you can do about it because we're broadcasting into space all the time. I don't mean SETI, but the local airport has radars. The military, of course, has radars, but there's also FM radio and television. All these signals go out into space. And if you're going to be paranoid about it and say, we better not do this, you have to shut all that down. And personally, I don't want to land in an airport at night when it's raining, when the radar doesn't work. So I'm against it.
Seth, a fairly new astronomical phenomenon has stirred up a lot of attention. They're called fast radio bursts. And lately, astronomers have been detecting repeating radio bursts that are transmitted on a regular cycle. Can you tell us about fast radio bursts and especially the repeating ones? And do you think they may be associated with ETIs?
Well, there's at least one astronomer who has suggested that, Avi Loeb, who was for many years the chair of the astronomy department at Harvard University, has certainly suggested that that might be true. Others have as well. Fast radio bursts were actually found in somebody's office at their desk. Guy's name was Duncan Lorimer, and he works at West Virginia University. And he was looking at some data that had been taken with a radio telescope in Australia years earlier. And he found that occasionally there would just be this quick burst of radio noise, like that. But so fast, like in an eye blink, you would hear this thing. And nobody knew what it was at first, and a lot of people didn't even think it was real. And that particular radio telescope had a microwave oven in the observing room. I happened to know it because I used it to heat up my lunches when I was there. But, you know, so was it just that, or was it real, and so forth? It eventually became real. Some of these things, I mean, there are dozens and dozens of these things known now, fast radio bursts, mostly found in Canada using an antenna up there. But some of them repeat. Right. You get a fast radio burst, whoop, like that. And then maybe 2 days later, you hear it again. Whoop. And if they repeat, that's a big deal for an astronomer, because now you can use specialized antennas, special telescopes, and look in the direction and just wait for it to repeat. And now you'll be able to get much better data and learn how far away it is and where it's coming from. These things come from very, very far away, Rick. I mean, in some cases, billions of light years away. Maybe they're aliens, but if they're aliens, it doesn't make much sense. Why, you know, a radio program that only lasts a tenth of a second isn't going to be very interesting, right? It just isn't. And besides that, How can you arrange that the aliens over there 3 billion light years are going to be coordinating with the aliens back behind me 3 billion light years so that they're all doing the same thing? I don't think it makes any sense to assume that it's aliens, but it is undoubtedly something interesting.
I've heard some scientists talking about looking for and transmitting flashes of laser beams as a communications tool. Can you tell us about this and any active initiatives for laser SETI?
Yeah, laser SETI is a thing, and I think it's going to become a bigger thing because so little of it has been done. We finally now have some technology that would allow us to look at big swaths of the sky for fast laser bursts. I mean, that's another way that they could get in touch. Maybe they don't know if there's anybody home here on Earth, some aliens, but maybe once every week or every 2 weeks or every 2 years, they just flash a laser at us, you know, just like a laser pointer, but they flash it in our direction for, I don't know, a millionth of a second, say. If that is happening, if you will go out in the night sky, look up, you're not going to see that because something that only lasts a millionth of a second once, you're just not going to, probably won't even tell your spouse because you figure, oh, something with my eyes, whatever. So this could be happening all the time, but finally we had the technology to look for these laser flashes. And frankly, lasers would be a great way to send a lot of information because you can get a lot more information on a light beam than you can on a radio beam. So yeah, maybe they're doing it and technology is allowing us to look.
You know that science fiction and science fact often collide and sometimes gets a little bit confused. There's been a couple of occurrences over the past couple of years that have raised some attention. Back in 2015, I remember there was a lot of online excitement about KIC 8462852, or Tabby Star. And observers here on Earth noticed some odd changes in the star's brightness, which seeded a number of online theories, including that it was actually a big megastructure created by an advanced alien civilization. Can you tell us about Tabby Star and how those incredible theories took root?
Yeah, well, I wish it were an alien construction. I'd probably get a raise from the boss. But in fact, this was a star that was being observed as part of the Kepler mission. This was a NASA mission. But in any case, this star would occasionally drop in brightness by 20%. Now, if you go out and look at the sun every day, I don't recommend you do that. But if you were to do that, you would find that the sun is always pretty much the same brightness. It varies by maybe one part in a thousand at most, never 20%, never, never. So what was causing this? And it was suggested by a fellow at Penn State University. Well, said, look, you know, it could be, as you say, a giant alien construction, something called maybe a Dyson sphere or something. Something that the aliens have built that's so big that it occasionally blocks light from their star. That would be important if true. But more recent observations of Tabby Star show that it has the kind of colors that would be caused by a star's light being blocked by dust, ordinary dust. There's a lot of dust in the universe. It's a dusty place. And so probably that's what it is and not aliens at all, which is a little disappointing.
And it sounds a little bit about the situation with Betelgeuse, that the brightness of the star dimmed a bit last year and then got bright and then dimmed again. It turned out that the results were of dust around the star itself.
Yeah, there's a lot of dust in the universe. And, you know, you can say, well, I mean, that's going to provide, you know, something to do when you get into space, clear out all the dust. But in fact, it does mean that we can be fooled into thinking that we're seeing some engineering project of the aliens, when in fact what we're seeing is something very natural.
Speaking of another odd sighting, such as what we just mentioned with Tabby Star, a year or so ago, our solar system was visited by what has been called an interstellar object. Now, I'm not sure of the pronunciation, so please, Oumuamua?
Yeah, Oumuamua.
You had mentioned Dr. Loeb a few minutes ago, and he has a new book out that has some interesting theories about Oumuamua.
Yes, he does. And what he's saying is that Oumuamua, yeah, everybody thinks it's an asteroid, a completely natural thing that came into our solar system from somebody else's solar system. Now, that part of the story, nobody disagrees with. It clearly came from somebody else's solar system. That's just physics due to Isaac Newton. We know that's true. But the question is, what is it? And a lot of people have seen this artist's impression that makes Oumuamua look like a bumpy cigar or something, an elongated thing. But that's just an artist's impression. You know, you couldn't see much more than one pixel of this thing because it's far away. It was 100 million miles away, and it isn't very big. If you took this thing and put it in a football stadium, it would more or less fit. So it's not that huge. And what it is, well, 9 out of 10 astronomers think it was indeed an asteroid. But Avi Loeb says, no, he thinks it might have been a remnant or a solar sail from an alien spacecraft. And after all, he's a smart guy. Mm-hmm. So even though he gets a lot of pushback on this idea, you know, you can't say he's absolutely wrong.
Thanks to ground-based and space telescopes, especially NASA's Kepler and now test missions, found thousands of extrasolar planets or exoplanets beyond our own solar system. And some of the confirmed planets include those described as Earth-like, were found in their host star's Goldilocks or habitable zone. Tell us, what's a Goldilocks zone and why might that be important in the search for alien life and possibly extraterrestrial intelligence?
The Goldilocks zone. It sounds like the place you ought to go if you're going to order soup. But in fact, the Goldilocks zone was just that distance from some star, whatever star you're talking about, at which the planet will be neither so cold that any water on it is totally frozen all the time, or so hot that any water on it is boiled off, mm-hmm. right? So that's the habitable zone. It's essentially defined by when water boils and freezes. Now, obviously, we live in the habitable zone because, you know, you can take a pail of water and put it outside, and in the winter it may freeze, and in the summer, well, it won't boil, but it'll evaporate quickly. So we're in the habitable zone, but random planets might not be, and those are the best places to look for life because life probably requires water or something like it.
Have SETI investigators been focusing on some of these exoplanets that are in a habitable zone?
You know, I mean, what can you do about them? Essentially, every other star, or maybe one star in three, if you're kind of a pessimistic kind of person, will have a planet about the same size as the Earth in their habitable zone. That's a recent research result. That's very encouraging. Look up at the sky. You see a lot of, you might see a couple hundred, a couple thousand stars, and think that one out of two or one out of three of the stars up there might have a planet that's a cousin of the Earth. So it's very encouraging in terms of being able to say that it's likely we have a lot of cosmic company.
Recently, I was reading on your website that a colleague of yours at SETI Institute and a scientist from NASA Goddard Space Flight Center recently identified a unique star system called TYC-7037-89-1. And I understand it's not just a binary or tertiary star system, but a multiple star system. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it turns out that, you know, stars are like kittens. You usually don't get one when you get a litter of kittens, right? I mean, you might, but mostly you get, you know, three or four. I don't know what the typical litter size is. Well, stars are something like that, too. You don't necessarily get three or four being born together, but you get two as often as you get one. In fact, slightly more often. So, you know, most stars have buddies, right? And sometimes you get a triple system and a quadruple system and even larger. And that just speaks to the circumstances of their birth. But it would be kind of nifty if anybody remembers the original Star Wars, when Luke Skywalker, you know, looks up in the sky, he sees two stars, not just one. So he has a two-star system. Mind you, maybe not a good deal for Luke Skywalker because, you know, being in an orbit around two stars has a lot of downsides that might ruin his whole day. But still, it's kind of an interesting view.
Seth, finally, this question I'm curious to ask you. Should signs of extraterrestrial intelligence someday be discovered, how would the SETI community handle the announcement? I'm sure that any public revelation would be protected with high security by governments around the world. Might we never know? Might there already have been discovered some extraterrestrial intelligence, but we don't know about it because they don't want to tell us about it?
Well, to begin with, looking for extraterrestrial intelligence is all being done by, you know, private, nonprofit research groups, not by the government. So they don't even have control of that information. But secondly, this idea that we wouldn't be told, the government wouldn't tell us, they'd keep it secret because why? Why wouldn't they tell us? It would be very interesting to say, oh, well, the public couldn't handle the news. But you know that's not true. If you just ask people walking down the street, hey, if the scientists announced tomorrow that they picked up a signal from ET, would you start rioting in the streets? Would you not go to work? Would you not go to school? What would you do? Mm-hmm. And the answer is they'd say, well, I'd want to read more about it. I mean, there's no policy of secrecy, and there's no way to keep it secret anyhow. So if it happens, you'll hear about it.
Seth, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and I'm hoping perhaps someday we may find it.
I hope so, too. Thanks very much, Rick.
That was Seth Shostak, the senior astronomer at the SETI Institute in Pasadena, California. He joined our program today via Skype. This is Rick Pantaleo. Thanks for listening today, and be sure to join Carol Castiel again next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News.